Okay, maybe we can start. Tonight I've just come back from overseas yesterday in Hong Kong for a few days, and I just come back here. And it's always interesting when you travel around because you, well, actually interesting for many reasons. One of the great things about traveling is that you see Buddhist people around the world. And one of the great things about being a monk is that whenever you travel anywhere in the world, you meet all these wonderful Buddhists everywhere, all these really nice people. So if you ever have any doubts about whether you should ordain or not, that in itself is a good reason for ordaining. All you meet is nice people everywhere. Do you always meet nice people in your daily life, or do you not? Most people don't, right? that is actually true to some. It's not perfectly, absolutely true, of course, because even when you're a monk, sometimes you meet people who are not 100% perfect, but a lot of the time you meet really nice people. One of the hidden benefits of being a monastic. So just letting you know in case you have any doubts about that. But one of the things that always happens when you travel around, you see what kind of problems people have in the meditation practice and in the spiritual life and all these kind of things. And so it's always, you know, nice to reflect on the sort of factors that lead to success in meditation and success in the spiritual life in general. What are the things, what are the kind of foundational things that ideally need to be in place for the whole path to come about and mature and also kind of come around as quickly as possible? Would you like some shortcuts in your meditation practice? Everybody wants shortcuts, and this is kind of the thing. So this is, today I'm going to tell you some secret shortcuts in meditation. One of the things about, you know, if you look at the history of Buddhism, one of the ways of understanding the history of Buddhism is to see it as the history of shortcuts on the Buddhist path. Because every time the Dhamma kind of moves into a new area, it's usually to create a shortcut. So kind of the whole history of Buddhism is kind of a history of shortcuts, how to get to the kind of goal more quickly. So I'm going to add another chapter tonight to that history of shortcuts. Actually, I'm not going to do that at all, I promise you. What I'm going to do instead is that after a while you understand that all these shortcuts, they don't really work. Instead of actually having a shortcut, you end up on a massive detour. You end up on the long cut, as I like to say, rather than the shortcut. And you never actually get to the goal. So one of the things that we need to do, and one of the things that I always like to emphasize, of course, is that let's go backwards instead. Let's go back to the word of the Buddha. What does the Buddha have to say about these things? Let's try to kind of take away some of this history. Go back to the origins. Go back to the source of these things. And that is where you find the real Buddhism. That's where you find the real shortcut. I know Ajahn Brahm likes to say the shortcut. This is the shortcut, It's pretty short, actually, especially since I shaved very recently, really, really short. So this, what it means, of course, is that monastic life is the, if you want a shortcut, that's really the shortcut. Anyway, to find that shortcut, to find out what the Buddha really has to say about those things that are foundational on the Buddhist path, one of those things is, I think I've said that here before on a few occasions, is you have to put those foundation stones in place. And one of those foundation stones is meeting people, superior people, those people who have practiced these teachings, those people who have insight into these teachings, and those people who support you on the path. The Kalyana Mitta. Kalyana Mitta is a Pali word which means good friendship. So you've got to have good friends. That's a pretty good deal. Everybody wants to have good friends anyway, so that's kind of a good starting point, isn't it? So who is number one good friend? Any ideas? What do you reckon? Who's number one good friend in this world? The Buddha, perhaps? Buddha is number one spiritual friend. And this is one of the reasons why we should hang out with that kind of people. I'd like to say we should hang out with the Buddha. How do we hang out with the Buddha? And of course the answer is, because we still have in the present day, we have a large number of discourses that in all probability were pretty much spoken by the Buddha as we have them now. To hang out with the Buddha just means to read some of those discourses and listen to some of the things that the Buddha has to say. It doesn't just have to be the Buddha. Sometimes you find other people who also are inspiring and have that feel about them, that they have some insight into the path. People like Ajahn Brahm perhaps, or other people who have this kind of something about them that tells you that there's some kind of sense of profundity there, which is very special. So this is the hanging out with the good people. And as you do that, you get this chance to, you know, to improve your understanding, to kind of to be gradually conditioned by those teachings. And of course, that conditioning, if it is the right one, it leads you towards happiness. Why is this so important? And the reason why it is so important, and that is that ancient simile I like to use of the ship on the ocean. In a sense, we are very much like ships on the ocean. But we are ships without any steering mechanism. There's no rudder, there's no sails, there's no engine, there's no oars, there's no paddle, there's nothing. It's just a hull, empty hull. And we are kind of this hull on the ocean. Now if a ship has no steering mechanism, it means that it drifts according to the prevailing conditions. So if the wind comes to the north from the north, the ship goes to the south. Current comes from the east, the ship goes to the west. It is completely dependent on the prevailing conditions. And we are, not just we, but any living being according to the Buddhist ideas, we are like ships on the ocean. We have no inherent steering mechanism inside of us. We depend on the external circumstances for whether we drift to the south. We drift to the north. Go to the east. Go to Sydney. Go to the west, into the ocean somewhere. So it's just, you know, we are exactly like our ship. We too drift around in the world in a very similar kind of way. And this is basically the Buddhist idea of non-self. There's no mechanism, finally, who decides which way we go, whether this way or that way. So what we have to do is that we have to make sure we get conditioned in such a way that we drift towards it. Happiness, we drift towards peace, we drift towards compassion, we drift away from anger, away from desire, away from delusion, confusion, restlessness, and all these other kind of negative things. So we have to ensure we get the wind and the current from the right direction. So ultimately, we drift towards nirvana and awakening itself. And that current in Buddhism, that wind which causes us to go in the right direction, that is the word of the Buddha. So get that wind, get the kind of get the hang of the word of the Buddha. Read it a little bit, try to figure out what it means. It's actually quite simple and straightforward very often. And then, whoosh, you're heading in the right direction. Get the Buddha to kind of push your boat a little bit in the right way, and then things are going right. And there's a very beautiful simile for this in the suttas. Well, some of the most powerful things about the Buddha's teachings are actually the similes that he gives. And there is, somewhere, I think there is a German scholar who took all the similes of the Buddha and collected them into one book. Unfortunately, it's in German, so you can't read it, but it's there anyway. And the similes are some of the most powerful things in the Buddhist teachings. And this particular simile that relates this idea of, in Buddhism, of, hanging out with the right people, with the Kalyanamitta, with the people who have understood with the Buddha and all of these kind of things, that relate to that and how that eventually pushes you all the way to awakening. It's a simile of the rain on the mountaintop. It's a very nice simile. So it rains on the mountaintop. And as it rains and rains and rains on that mountaintop, as you continue studying these discourses from the Buddha 2,500 years old, as you keep that rain coming, the rain collects into little streams. And as the rain collects into little streams, it rains more and more and more. The streams go into the lakes. And the lakes overflow into the large lakes. And the large lakes overflow into the large rivers. The Ganges rivers, these enormous rivers in the world, the Brahmaputra. I'm not sure if the Swan River really counts in this connection, but we can take it in there just for good measure. And then eventually, that those rivers, they go into the ocean. And all you have to do is to keep the rain coming. Yeah, that's all you have to do. As the drops come down, one after the other, again and again and again, week after week, month after month, year after year, eventually it fills up the ocean itself just by doing that much. Yeah, and that is reading the suttas. That is hearing a good Dhamma talk which expresses those suttas in the right way. That's where it all comes from. You're gradually conditioning yourself, and you feel the effect of that conditioning because your life becomes easier, your life becomes more happy, you feel more at peace, you feel more able to deal with people around you on a daily basis. Everything becomes so smooth as you do that. Sounds attractive, right? Yeah, sounds good. Would you like that? If you would, you're in the right place. That's what I say. So this is the first one. I've talked about this before. And I love that simile. I think you can probably come and give every Dhamma talk on Friday night just on that particular simile, and that would be sufficient. After a while, the audience might go down a little bit, yeah. But at least we have that nice simile every time. Sometimes it is surprising how much the Buddha repeats himself in the discourses. But actually, very often that repetition is required because you just need to be reminded of the basics. And as you are reminded of the basics, kind of you go in the right direction here. So anyway, I'm going to leave that aside for now, and I'm going to look at something else. And this is also about the kind of conditioning process, those basic things that have to be in place for the Dhamma to work. And this particular a way of approaching things is found in something called the Satipatthana Sangyutta. Satipatthana, for those of you who have been around Buddhism for a while, you will know Satipatthana is all about meditation practice. It's about meditation on the breath. It's about overcoming the hindrances inside that block us from going forward, and all of these kind of things. It's one of the most important ways of understanding the meditation practice in the Buddhist teachings. Satipatthana can be translated as something like application of mindfulness, the focus of mindfulness, how we use our awareness to focus in an appropriate way that leads us forward on this path. Yeah, that's what Satipatthana really is about. First of all, we give rise to mindfulness. That's what we tried before in the meditation, yeah? And then you apply that mindfulness in the right way. But the Buddha says, very interesting, there are two things that are at the foundation, the root of all of this, that make this mindfulness, that make the whole meditation process possible in the first place. Yeah, two things. And those two things the Buddha talks about, yeah, this is the foundation of the path of meditation. So really exciting stuff. One of those, very easy, I think you all know that already, that is morality. You have to live life well. If you live life well, then things tend to go easily and smoothly. The other thing, which is kind of more not so obvious perhaps, is something called Ujjukha Ditti in the Pali language. And it basically means straight view. Yeah, straight view is this other thing. And that is going to be the main topic of my talk tonight. But before I get into that, I will just talk very briefly about morality and the importance of morality on the Buddhist path. I'm sure many of you already have a good feel for that, why it is important, all of this, because it really is foundational. It's absolute requirement for meditation to work. And it's one of those, I think, often things that are lacking in the world of mindfulness practice that we see around us. Why is morality so important? And the reason why it is so powerful, because it makes the present moment pleasant. Yeah, this is one of those nice Ajahn Brahm catchphrases. Make the present moment a pleasant moment. Why is that? Because you feel good about yourself. Yeah, you live well. You are kind towards others. You are generous with your time and resources. You are compassionate and understanding. And then when you sit down, you just feel, whoa, I'm actually living well. Yeah, it's like you congratulate yourself in a wholesome way. And this is another one of those beautiful similes of the Buddha where he explains how this works. And he says that it is just as if you have a mountain, yeah, there's a mountain and there's a house on the mountain slope. And then in the evening, when the sun goes down behind the mountain, there's a shade that gets cast over this whole mountain slope, enveloping, covering, completely encircling that house. There's no part of that house that isn't enveloped and covered by that shadow of the mountain. And exactly the same thing here. When you really live well, in body, speech, ideally also in mind. That's why we do some metta meditation here sometimes. So all three, body, speech and mind. When you live well and you maximize that, you take it to the highest level that you're able to through your commitment and perseverance on the Buddhist path. If you do that, it is as if this mountain of good actions, the mountain of good actions come to you. So when you sit down in the evening, when you relax after a long day's work, you feel that mountain come back to you, and you cannot avoid feeling good about yourself. You feel, hooray, yay, I'm living well. What a wonderful thing that is. And you feel really, you feel pleased with yourself in a wholesome, non-egotistical, non-self-centered way. Because the mountain of good actions is so large, you can't avoid being happy. That's how I'm good. Can't avoid being happy. Is that something? Sometimes we're kind of striving to be happy, and here actually is the solution to feel that degree of happiness for yourself. So these are the similes used by the Buddha. And to me, I always find that so encouraging and uplifting, some of these very basic similes. So that is the morality aspect. Now, I've talked briefly about the idea of kalyanamitta, good friendship, the rain on the mountain, and then the idea of morality, why morality is so important. Now, I want to talk about ujjukaditti, straight view. So the idea of straight view basically refers to our outlook in life. How we look at things, how we look at the world, how we look at the people around us, how we look at ourselves. Our outlook. From outlook, the way we look at the world, that is where our values come from. How we look at things, how we regard things, how we think about the world, how we perceive things gives rise to our values. What is valuable to us? What matters in our life? What is important to us? So once the view is in place, everything else, what matters, what is important, outlook, values, all of that tends to come from that. So the idea of outlook for that reason is a nice way of translating ujjukaditti as outlook, becomes very significant, because once that outlook is right, once your values are in the right place, then you naturally steer towards those things that are, if your values are in accordance with the Dhamma, so to speak, you will steer in the right way, and you will practice in the right way, and then you get the results of the path. So what we value, what is important to us, our outlook is for that reason very, very fundamental as well. And the more it aligns with reality, the more it aligns with the way things actually are, the more it aligns with reality, the more we're able to practice this path in the right way. So what are these values? What are these things that I'm talking about? I will talk about a few things, the way to look at the world in such a way that it actually aligns the way we see things with the way things actually are. And one of these ways, one of these kind of very basic ways of understanding the world and looking at the world is, of course, to remember the idea of impermanence. Anicca in the Pali language. This is right outlook according to Buddhism. When you see things according to impermanence, actually I often prefer other words for anicca. Impermanence to me is a bit kind of dry perhaps, but I like things like unreliability, I think is a nice translation for anicca. It's unreliable. Something which is unreliable, it kind of straight away, for me, makes me withdraw from that. You can't trust it. That's just like you can't trust an unreliable friend. So anicca is actually one of these very powerful things. What is it that is anicca in the world? What are the main problems that are anicca? The main things that are anicca are the things that belong to the world outside of us. Yeah, things that we see through the eyes, things that we hear, our possessions, our relationships, and all of these things, our family even, all the things that are external to us is the main area of things that are impermanent. Why? Because things external to us, we can't really control them. Yeah, because they are outside, they tend to go according to their own causes and conditions, and the amount of ability that we have to control those things is actually very limited. Yeah, so just that much, just reminding yourself that if it is external to you, then it is actually already very unreliable and very hard to do anything with. So why is it? One of the problems here, yeah, one of the problems with this is that very often it feels like we are in charge. It feels like we have some control over these things. So why is there often this mismatch between the way the world is and how we feel about the world? Why is there a mismatch there? And the reason that there is a mismatch is because it feels like, this is again back to that illusion of self again, yeah? It feels like we are in charge. It feels like we have agency. It feels like we can do things in the world. This is a very important part of the sense of self, the fact that it feels like we have this ability to control things in the world. So that is why there is a mismatch. And that is why it is so important to reflect on that. Because as you reflect on that, you reduce the distance between the mismatch, between your feeling what the world actually is and how the world actually operates. By reducing the mismatch, you are enabling yourself to live more in accordance with the real world. Yeah, this is why this reflection is so important. And as you do that, your outlook, your values start to align with the Dhamma. And, you know, one way of doing this, one of the kind of obvious ways to do this is that, you know, sometimes when you look at the world, and I know many people, they kind of despair at the state of the world sometimes. Yeah, oh, the world is going to the, some people say to the dogs, other people say somewhere else, it's not kind of going in the right direction. You know, you look at the political scene in certain places, you look at the environment, you look at the refugee crisis. Yeah, there seems to be so innumerable, impossible, many problems. You see the kind of the drug-resistant viruses and bacteria around the world, yeah. And it all seems so, sometimes you look at all this, this is insoluble, you can't do anything about this. And sometimes people feel really depressed about it. But why are we getting depressed? Why are we allowing this to happen to us? And the reason is because there's too much distance between the way we think the world should be, the control that we think we have, and the way the world actually is. Yeah, so every time you look at the world and you feel, whoa, it's going the wrong way. What's happening here? This is really depressing. Actually, no. This is anicca. This is precisely unreliability. This is precisely impermanence. The world is never going to go the way we think it should be going. It's never going to go in ideal direction. It is always going to be uncertain this way. Yeah, we think we live in a peaceful time, but before you know it, we have wars again. Actually, there's plenty of wars going on right now around the world. But before you know it, we are involved in these things again. In my lifetime, I've never kind of been even close to a war zone in my lifetime. But you know, suddenly, before you know it, things are back in that direction again. This is really Buddhism 101. So every time you open a newspaper, every time you hear something about the world, it is a potential teaching for you of how the world actually is. And you are starting to align things up more according to reality. That is one way of doing that. So remember that. So what do we do then? Where can we go? Where can we find a sense of security from this? If the world outside is so unreliable, including our family members as well, yeah, our relationships, everything we own and we think is ours in the world, again, that delusion of self, I own, I'm in charge. Actually, you're not. Nature is in charge. Yeah, nature is going to eventually come back and reclaim its own, so to speak. Yeah. So what can we do? And what we have to do, there is one area in life that we have some say over, yeah? And that area that we have some say over is our own inner life. That's one of the few places where actually we can do something. We can have some say over what we intend. Yeah? We have some say about how we look at and perceive the world, how we think about the world. And if we do these things in the right way, then of course we are creating happiness. We are creating good causes for ourselves. So what we do, once we start to understand impermanence, the problems in the world, we turn our attention in a different direction. We turn it in the direction of looking at our inner lives rather than the outer life outside of us. We turn it in the direction where we actually have some degree of control, some ability to do something. Yeah, and as you do this, the more you do this, the more you kind of move your attention around in a different direction, starting to work with your inner life, not worrying so much about the outer things, gradually, your outlook, what you value in the world, what is important, your changes, yeah. You are like this train moving forward at high speed, yeah, full of Western Australian iron ore or something like that, weighing thousands of tons, yeah, going 100 kilometers an hour up in the Pilbara somewhere. And then you want to move this train in a different direction. Wow, it's really hard because it's so heavy and it's going so fast. But you can. We are like these trains. We are like these trains because our habits are so strong. Our views are so powerful. But if you keep on reflecting on these things, even your train, yeah, even everyone's train in here starts to move in a different direction. It is hard because our trains are so stubborn. I know this from personal experience, right? Trains are so stubborn, but gradually, coming around until one day you are going 180 degrees in the opposite direction from where you were going before. Yeah, this is how things shift. You're changing your views. You're literally turning around 180 degrees from where you were going before. And it's so liberating, it's so freeing, because your values have changed so much. That is one example. Yeah, this idea of impermanence is actually very, very powerful. And when you understand it fully, you understand that there is really nothing in this world that you can grasp onto. There's nothing you can hold onto, because it is almost as if the ground beneath our feet is continuously shaking. Sometimes the shaking is quite weak. Sometimes it's almost like an earthquake. Yeah, and when there's an earthquake, what happens is that you fall over. And when you fall over, you hurt yourself. It's always shaking. There's nowhere to stand. There's nowhere to hold on to her. There's nothing to attach to her. As soon as you attach, you risk falling over as a consequence. That is basically what impermanence is like. When this becomes a deep understanding inside of you, that's 180 degrees change from your previous way of looking at things. So that is one way of changing our views, yeah? Of looking, aligning our views with the nature of reality and the way things actually are. And that is one we can experience for ourselves. Just open the blooming newspapers and you will see these things happening around you. Another way, and this is something that is not as easily observed, yeah, some people observe this, but actually they are probably in a minority. And this is the Buddhist idea of rebirth. Yeah, very foundational idea in Buddhism, the idea that we die and then kind of move on into a future life. And this idea too has this ability of changing our outlook and changing our values if we understand it in the right way. So what does it mean that we get reborn? And one of the fundamental things that it means when you get reborn into a new life is obviously that you have to leave so much stuff behind. Yeah, pretty much everything has to be left behind. Yeah, everything except for one thing. There is one thing that you take with you from one life to the next one. And what is that? It is your mind. Yeah, the mind moves on from one life to the next one. So if you are going to be wise, if you're going to live well, you want to invest in that thing which stays with you for the long term. Yeah. Otherwise you come to the end of your life, you've invested everything in this life into family and relations and friends and all that. Of course, we need to invest in these things to some extent, of course. But if everything is invested in that and nothing is invested in your mind, then you come to your deathbed and you think, oh, everything is gone. and you feel confused and uncertain, and you don't know what to do with yourself, and you're moving into the future with this kind of sense of confusion and dread and delusion. You don't know what's happening yet. So it changes our outlook. Instead of just investing everything in this existence, we start to invest for the long term, investing in the mind itself. We make the mind a place of light, of brightness, a place of kindness, a place that is happy, a place that is joyful, where we'd like to be, a place that is tranquil, a place where there is compassion and kindness for the world. Yeah. And we build this up inside our mind. And when we come to our death, we feel that we have lifted ourselves up from where we started out. And we really feel that we have lived well. And we're all set up for a future existence, for life going into the future. It's such a beautiful way of thinking at the world. And it doesn't, and what is even better about it, it doesn't mean that we neglect the things in this life, yeah? It doesn't mean that at all. It's not as if we kind of, you know, discard all the things in this life and just now just practice the spiritual path. No, what it means is that it has value for this life as well. Yeah, it also improves everything we do in this life, our relationships, the way we deal with all people around us, our ability to enjoy the world as it is here and now. Because just because you have faith or confidence in the idea of rebirth, it doesn't mean that you are thinking about it all the time. In fact, it's almost the exact opposite that happens. Because you know the power of changing your mind to enable you to kind of deal with that rebirth thing, it tends to draw you into the present moment. Because now is where I create that karma. Now is where I create that beautiful mind that actually will be available for me throughout future, even after I die. So actually, it tends to make you more mindful. It gives you more quality of life here and now, rather than somehow start making you fantasize and think about the future instead. So it has a twofold thing. Increases your value in this life and also does something for the future as well in this way. So in this way, it is very powerful. And one of the, again, the nice similes that I have spoken about here before that the Buddha uses to explain this is the simile of the borrowed goods. And I love this simile because to me it was always very clear and very spoke very directly to me. The simile of the borrowed goods is what the Buddha talks about sensual things in the world. They are like borrowed goods. Imagine a man or a woman or somebody who borrows all kind of stuff. And of course, soon enough afterwards, after they borrowed it, they have to give it back again. You don't really get a chance to be too attached, to have too much craving for it. Because soon enough, the owner comes back and says, I will take it back again. You have borrowed it long enough. But of course, the point is that everything in our life is just like that. It is all like borrowed goods. Because when we die at the very latest, it has to be given back to its owner again. The owner being nature itself. Everything goes. Everything goes back to the source, to where it originally came from. So the question then is, how much are we going to invest in the borrowed stuff? And how much are we going to invest in the stuff which is much more our own, that we carry with us into the future? And that is what the idea of rebirth does for us when we think about it in the right way. Again, it changes our values slowly. It changes our values to, instead of what we achieve in this life, what becomes much more important than the what we achieve is how we achieve things. We achieve things in the right way, with the right quality of heart, with the right understanding, with the right morality, with the right outlook. That becomes much more important to us than the what we achieve in whatever area it might be that we wish to achieve something. So you don't kind of compromise your values, don't compromise your morality just because you can achieve something in this life that might seem very important, for this life's sake. So that is the idea of rebirth. How that kind of outlook, from a Buddhist point of view, we regard this as how the world actually is. So for us, for me, it is it actually is this way. So we are aligning your view again with reality as it is. There's a third way I want to talk about impermanence, talked about rebirth briefly. A third thing that I just wish to bring up briefly is the idea of suffering. Or happiness, if you like. These are two sides of the same coin. And to understand this in the right way, reflect on this in the right way. So again, this too becomes a force in our spiritual practice, a force in our meditation practice. And the way to think about suffering and happiness, one of the ways I recommend you to do it, look at your meditation practice. Now I'm coming back to things that we can observe directly for ourselves again. This is not kind of theory or something you have to take on board on confidence. Look at your meditation practice. Look at what happens as you become more peaceful. Look at the happiness in the mind, the happiness you feel when the restlessness and all the problems in life die down and you start to become peaceful. Look at that. And when you see that, you are seeing an alternative kind of happiness. You are seeing a reduction in suffering that the vast majority of people in the world never get a chance to see. You're seeing an alternative way. You're seeing something else. Notice the happiness that comes from meditation practice. And every time your meditation goes deeper, there comes a point where maybe you start to feel a sense of joy in your meditation practice. Notice that. It is extremely powerful because it is showing you a different area where there is joy and happiness in the world apart from where we normally find it. Every time you go deeper, it changes your values, it changes your outlook, it changes the things that you give significance in this world. Your freight train is starting to head in a different direction, Your habits are going a different way, and your values are changing accordingly. One of the things that you see as you do this, one of the very powerful things that you see here, is that so much of our life is run by cravings, desires, restlessness, agitation of mind, all of these kind of things. One of the things that you see in your meditation practice, you see that all of that actually is a big hassle. It's a big problem. You see how it makes you feel incomplete. How it makes you feel like there's this scratch inside of you that you always have to scratch, this itch that you have to keep scratching all the time. But in meditation practice, you start to see the craving itself, the desire itself, is dying down. This is what meditation in part is about. Peace is the opposite of craving, is the opposite of desire. No more movement of the mind. So what you're seeing there is the suffering of craving itself. How problematic it is, because it agitates us. It makes us restless and gives all these kind of problems for us. And that is a very, very useful thing to see, because it moves you very powerfully away from those ordinary pursuits of the world towards a more spiritual lifestyle and a spiritual path. And you keep on doing that. And as you do this, and as your meditation becomes more profound and more peaceful and all of these kind of things, there comes a time when meditation becomes so powerful, so beautiful, so different from anything that you have ever seen in this world, where the whole world starts to shut down. And when the world starts to shut down and you feel complete contentment inside, that is where you see a completely alternative way of existence, where there is a much more powerful sense of contentment, happiness, well-being than you've ever seen before in your life. And you feel like, and this is what I have said here before, it feels a bit like you have found the answer to the question of the meaning of life itself. Sounds impossible, That's what it feels like. You've turned your freight train around 180 degrees and you're looking at the world in a completely different way from what you ever did before. And again, this is what happens purely through investigating your meditation, through understanding where real happiness lies. And again, outlook changes, values change, what you place importance on in this world comes around in a completely different way here. So these are three examples for you. I could take more examples if you know, maybe another time, but We could talk about things like non-self, about karma, about all of these other things that belong to the kind of sphere of straight view in Buddhism. But these three examples are already enough to give you some idea what this is about. And what you see when you think about this, when you look at this, is that what we are seeing here, this idea of straight view, basically is just another way of looking at what in Buddhism we call right view. Yeah, right view is precisely looking at things in accordance with the reality. And as you do that, that is where the path really takes off. And this is why you can start to see now right view is at the beginning of this path. It's the very foundation stone upon which everything else is based. And when you have right view in this way, all the other factors tend to come along as a consequence. Yeah. It has to, because right view, right outlook, it does precisely what I've been talking about now. And eventually it comes around and you start to look at things in a completely different way from what you did before. And that is why it is so powerful. But one of the important things here, and one of the things that I really want to emphasize tonight, is that sometimes people think that this idea of right view is like an assent. I agree to a certain set of rules, yeah? Like rules like, you know, there is rebirth, yeah? There is karma, there is enlightened one, the Buddha, and then everybody says Amen afterwards. Yeah? But it doesn't work like that in Buddhism. It's not as simple as that. Amen, I think it means something like I agree, apparently is the root meaning of the word Amen. But so I agree, I consent. You have the Buddhist trinity of three things. But Buddhism doesn't work like that. That's not the point. The point is that the idea of right view at the root, at the foundation of the Buddhist path, it is a starting point. You start with that, and then you reflect on it in the ways that I have been explaining now. And when you reflect on these things in the right way, that is when they become powerful things in our life. It's not just about saying, yeah, I've got right view, what's the next thing to do? It doesn't work like that. We have to build up this right view, yeah? Build it up, make it something personal, internalize it, make it a force inside our own lives. And when it becomes a force in your life, that is when it really pushes you off in the right direction, spiritual life and also meditation at the same time. And the things that I've been talking about tonight are just ways to help you to think about certain aspects of right view in such a way that it actually becomes a force in your life. So for this reason, it means that an important part of the Buddhist teaching is reflecting on these teachings. What do they mean to me? Yeah. How do they actually empower me in the right way so that I will be heading off in the right direction? Yeah, that is such an important part of these teachings. And then they become really, really powerful. So, if you're sitting here tonight, yeah, you're sitting here in your meditation, sitting down, and as you were sitting down, what happened? Did you think about anything? Did anybody have a single thought? Or was everybody absolutely peaceful over the last half an hour we had? Right? I bet that 100% of you had at least one thought during the meditation. 90% was just, thinking, everywhere, all the time, you know, can't get rid of the thinking mind. Just all the way through. So what is going on there? And what is going on there? Many things are going on. One thing is that we are tired. I'm actually quite tired tonight myself. I'm amazed that I'm able to talk at all. But it's what's going on there? We are tired. We are restless. We come from work. Our mind is kind of overwrought with stuff. We have already been, you know, thinking so much throughout the whole week. And all of that, of course, feeds into the meditation in a in this way. But one of the main reasons why we think so much in meditation, one of the reasons why probably not a single person here today, including me, I admit, me too, every one of us, maybe except for Venerable Sampa, he looks very peaceful over there, but the reason is precisely because our values are in the wrong place. Yeah, and this is a thing that you find out, especially when you go on retreat. I would really recommend you, if you are serious about your meditation practice, go on a retreat every now and again, and you really get to figure out where your meditation is at, where your mind is at, what you are doing with yourself. All of these things tend to come out clearly once you go on retreat. And what you start to see when you go on retreat, you start to see what's going on in your mind, what your values really are. Yeah. I should have said this at the beginning, because this is kind of an interesting thing, is what are our values? Yeah, and I'm sure many of you who come here, you will say, my value is kindness, my value is compassion, my value is wisdom. Yeah, and if you ask me, I probably say the same thing. Because we are, you wouldn't be here unless you had some of these values. Yeah, unless you come here to steal these talks and kind of take them out and sell them on the marketplace afterwards. I can assure you they're not worth all that much if you're wasting your time anyway. But you have come here because you are good-hearted, right? Accept it, face it. That's the reality here. So we think of ourselves as having these values. But then you go on a meditation retreat. After a couple of days, the most basic of the thinking mind has kind of settled down. The restlessness has disappeared a little bit. But still, the mind often keeps on thinking. And that is where you find out what you truly value in life. Yeah, because your mind is still hanging out in those sticky areas. Despite the fact that you are rested, you're becoming a little bit peaceful, the problems are still there. And what is it that you see here? Well, what you see is that you are still have a lot of attachment, a lot of value in the ordinary world. Yeah? In the pleasures of the ordinary world. In attachment maybe to your job. Certainly attachment to our family. Almost everyone has some attachment to our family, and it would be very strange if we didn't have that. But you see where your real values are here. If you really valued the spiritual life completely, and that was at the top of the hierarchy, then whenever you sit down, you feel peaceful. Not whenever you sit down. That's an exaggeration, because life isn't that simple. There's no such thing as whenever you sit down or whenever you do anything. It doesn't work like that. But generally speaking, especially when you go on retreat, your mind becomes peaceful because your mind is inclining towards spiritual things. You're not interested in the worldly stuff. And then peace happens as a matter of course. Being spiritual doesn't mean that you fantasize about meditation and fantasize about all these kind of things, yeah? If you sit here, closing your eyes, and you fantasize about meditation, that would really be paradoxical, wouldn't it? As if, you know... But that's not what happens. So, you know what you value in life by looking at the world in this way, by looking at yourself and looking at where your mind is. Yeah, and what we're trying to do is to change our values so that actually what we value are these other things instead. The peace, the tranquility and the happiness. And then when you become peaceful, when you meditate, that is when you know that you are valuing the right things in the world. Those things that lead to peace and tranquility. So check this out. Know what's going on inside of you. And as you do that, you start to value those things that really are important in life. And your mind and everything turns around and follows around as a consequence. So ideally, you know, the way I like to put it is that instead of fantasizing about the pleasures of the world while you meditate, you should really fantasize about meditation while you're living your ordinary life. Yeah, so if you find yourself running around in your ordinary life, doing things, getting stressed out, and you fantasize about meditation, oh, then you are certainly heading in the right direction because your values are in the right place. So this is just a way of thinking about values, thinking about things. And as you do that, it becomes a power, a real power in your spiritual life. It enables you. It enables the Noble Eightfold Path. It enables your meditation practice. And there comes a point where you start to think of your whole life in terms of spiritual powers, spiritual practice, spiritual endeavors. Yeah, that's where it comes a point. So whenever you do something in life, you start to look at the broader picture. How does this fit into my spiritual path? Including your work, including your family life, including everything else you do. Instead of thinking that my meditation practice is there to support my ordinary life so I can have a better relationship with my family and colleagues, that kind of stuff. Instead of thinking that your meditation is there to support your ordinary life, yeah, what that means is that you give priority to your ordinary life, and meditation and spiritual life is secondary. Instead of thinking like that, you think, how can I use my ordinary life to be a support for my spiritual life and my meditation practice? Once you have done that, you have turned it completely upside down. And suddenly, your ordinary life becomes a support instead for your spiritual life. Your spiritual life is primary here. Your ordinary life is secondary down here somewhere. That is when you know that you're heading in a different direction. In reality, there will be a bit of flip-flopping like that, yeah? That's just the nature of the mind. But we're trying to keep it that way as much as possible. And when you do that, what happens? It doesn't mean that you kind of chuck out your children out of your house, anything like that. Or, you know, anything worse. What it means is that your entire life increases in value. Entire life becomes more bearable and livable because suffering is falling away. You know where the real values are to be found in this world. Okay. That is all for tonight. So, awesome, 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 as Adam Brown would say. So that's great. So now, if you would like to ask some questions about this talk tonight, you are very welcome to do so now. And if you don't ask any questions, you might be reborn as a frog in your next life. This is one of the things, isn't it? So it's always... So please don't feel shy about asking questions. I always say, if you have a really stupid question, that's especially when you should ask it. Because usually the kind of question everybody wants to ask, but nobody dares to ask. Because they think they might make a fool of themselves. Everybody is supremely content with this nice talk. Wow, that is astonishing. That is really nice. You have a last chance. Over here. Okay, great.
How do we try to minimize the suffering to others as our path changes?
Okay, that's a good question. So you are saying if your values are different from the people around you, maybe family members and friends, how do you avoid conflict happening as a consequence of that? And how do you kind of make those things work out, I suppose? So basically, I think... The most important thing about what happens when our values change is the way we treat other people. Yeah, that's one of the most important things that happens. And I think as your values change, you become very, very aware of how you affect other people around you, and especially your intention. Make sure your intentions are always pure. Huh? And when you start to change, if that is one of the main factors of how you live your spiritual life, generally speaking, people around you will actually react in a very, very positive way, because they actually feel that you have more intentions of kindness, you have more intentions of all of these wholesome things. Of course, there are other aspects to this spiritual path, but that is one of the most important ones. And I have often used the example of my own life, my own family. When I first became a monk, my father told me that we have failed in our upbringing. That's what the first thing he said, And I thought, whoa, okay. So I knew it was a probably passing phase, Of course, sometimes parents are shocked. My parents didn't know anything about Buddhism. They thought I was disappearing into some kind of cult or something. So obviously they were a bit concerned about that. Fair enough. I don't have a problem with that. But what I did over time was I realized that, first of all, I'm not going to be able to preach to them. Yeah, you can't preach to your parents. That's just impossible. So it's only going to be one way this is going to work, and that is by the power of example. So that's what I meant when I said kindness to the people around us. Yeah, we become an example of a Buddhist or spiritual practitioner. Yeah? And we become that when they see that we are changing. Yeah? We are becoming more happy ourselves. Yeah? We start treating our parents differently. Yeah, I guess I was just a teenager like everyone else. I was a bit of a scallywag when I was a teenager. Yeah? And then you become less of a scallywag. And you think, wait a minute, this Buddhism is doing something good to our son. Yeah? And this is exactly what happened to me. Yeah? And it had a very, very powerful effect on my parents. Extremely powerful. And this has to do with Dhamma. This has nothing to do with me or my parents as such, maybe, except that my parents are quite open-minded people, I suppose. But the effect was, over a period of it took a long time, 10, 12, 15 years, the turn from being completely anti, yeah, our spirit, our bringing has failed, to essentially becoming Buddhists. Yeah, today my parents are, you know, they listen to my talks on the internet. Yeah, my father listens to his son's internet talks. That's kind of, for me, absolutely mind-boggling. I'm not sure how that happened, but it has happened. And this, I think, is the power of the Dhamma, these teachings, especially when they are lived. I'm not going to brag too much about myself, but when they are lived reasonably well, yeah, they actually have an extraordinary power on the people around us. So that, I think, is the most important thing. And eventually, it will tend to bring people around, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, very. Okay. Think about it a little bit. Okay. Anyone else? Eddie, maybe just give other people a chance before you, because you are quite regular on the questioning. Does anybody else like to ask any questions before we give Eddie the opportunity? Yeah? No, Eddie, you're more than welcome. I just want to give everybody an opportunity. Yeah?
Ajahn Brahmali, my question is regarding desire brings suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Buddha did say desire brings suffering. In the suttas, he also mentioned, you know, having desire is suffering, not having desire is also suffering. Got
not,
it?
Not, yeah. Not having desire is suffering. Yeah.
Well, what I mean is, when he said having desire is suffering, yeah, he was referring to the Sangha. You know. He was talking this to the monks and nuns, you know, desire being suffering. You know. For the lay people, that's why I got it, okay? That's why, it's not the desire for lay people. For lay people, it's the craving, you know, the excess of desire that brings suffering.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Am I right to say this?
All desire is suffering. Yeah, I agree with you that there is a difference there, perhaps, between how we practice the path, a little bit between monastics and lay people. Obviously, there has to be, because the life is a bit different. But for everyone, we're trying to gradually move away from both desire and craving. Yeah, because it is suffering. Just feel it in your own life. You know, when desire and craving is very strong, how do you feel? It doesn't feel. It feels hot. It feels agitated. It feels there's a lack there. There's a sense of incompleteness and lack of being fulfilled, etc.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Sorry, but for lay people, sometimes desire is. I mean, a little bit of this. Maybe middle way, you know. Yeah. A little bit of desire. That's part of our human nature, isn't it?
There is no human nature.
Like a human, like, you know. Well, we're living in a lay person's life. You know?
Yeah, it's okay, but just contemplate it and move, try gradually if you can to move away from it. That's really the answer, I think. Yeah. So just I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's suffering, and suffering, I guess, is bad in a certain way, but it's something we don't want. So just reflect on it.
Gradually.
Yeah. Thanks, Eddie. Yeah. Okay, we've got a few questions from one from Australia and a couple from overseas. This is from Pasanna from Southern Australia, who I know a little bit from over the internet. So hello, Pasanna. Question: with anicca and conditioned views, does social activism have a place in Buddhism? How can one be more effective by stepping back? I think social activism can have a place in Buddhism as long as we do it in the right way. Yeah, it's all about doing it in a way whereby we're coming from a good place and we don't allow us to be affected by too much anger and negative qualities. And this is, I think, one of the problems sometimes with activism, is that sometimes it's coming from the wrong place. Very often you hear about people who are activists that say that their activism is fueled by anger. And when I hear it's fueled by anger, I think that's not the right way of doing things. That's not the Buddhist way. Yeah, it's got fueled by compassion. If it's fueled by compassion and we make good karma in that way, then I think that is a wonderful thing to do. So use it as a field of merit, as a field of improving your own Buddhist practice. Then you are doing things in the right way. Then you can do a bit of social activism if you wish. But remember also, sometimes the social activism is often a response to kind of to the world going in the wrong way. The, you know, the anicca, the impermanence of things. And it's important to remember that you do social activism without being too caught up in the result. Because the result is so unpredictable. It's so unreliable. There comes a point when you just have to let go because actually it doesn't really work out the way you thought things were going to work out. The world is too unpredictable. Or you solve one problem, another one pops up, which is 10 times worse. Yeah. So this is the problem with this. The world is inherently uncontrollable. One of the reasons why we have social activism is again because we want to control things. But we can't do that. It comes from this deep-seated sense of control inside of us. When you give up the control, I think you tend to be much more chilled about these things in general. So how you can be more effective by stepping back? Well, more effective is by cultivating the right qualities inside of you. Yeah, cultivating that compassion. Be a social activist for the right reason, coming from the right place. Then you will be far more effective because you will be more clear-eyed about things. One of the problems with anger, it tends to blind us. It tends to see only one side of the issue, etc. When you step back a little more and you have more compassion, more peace in your heart as a consequence, you will actually have also much more clarity about what you're doing. Your decisions will be far better as a consequence. Yeah, and sometimes, you know, if you are a monastic, you don't do much social activism usually, but still, you can often be have a very, very good impact on the world overall. Look at the Buddha and what kind of impact his life had. It's been enormous in so many ways. Okay, second question. This is from Wolfram from Germany. If there is no self, what makes feelings so important? Why does love feel so good? What is a feeling? Are feelings part of the mind, or is all just a process? I am what I feel? Feelings are just feelings. Yeah, the fact that there are feelings doesn't mean that there is anything behind it more than the feeling themselves. If you look at feelings carefully, and this is one of the things that is so useful about looking at these things with insight and with the clarity of mind, is precisely you can see the conditioned nature. You can see how they come, how they change, how they eventually cease as well. So just because feeling feels good, yeah, or bad or neutral, whatever, it has nothing to do with whether it is a self or not. Just because, you know, love it feels good, doesn't mean that, that any self in relation to that. The importance of feelings is simply that we want to feel good. That's why it's important. Yeah, everyone wants to feel good. That's kind of what it's all about. That's why we practice this path. That's kind of the bottom line. That's what drives us in life with everything, is feelings. Because we are feeling beings, that's why we act, that's why we do. Because we want to optimize the positive feelings and minimize the negative ones. That's just directly looking at the nature of what it is to be a human being, or any being for that matter. Are feelings part of the mind, or is it just a process? It's both part of the mind and a process. Yeah, these are not in contradiction. This is the same thing. Yeah? I am what I feel. No, you are. This is the point. You're not what you feel. You're not what you think. You're not what you feel. You are a process. That's the whole point. Feeling is part of that process that you think you are, but when you look at it carefully, it turns out. And this, of course, is that very profound Buddhist insight, when you see the emptiness of all that, there's nothing there. And that is when you have a real revolution in consciousness. That's when that 180 degree flip in values happens completely here. Okay, the last one is from Milika, from Serbia. From Serbia, that's really cool. I don't think I've had a question from Serbia before. Ajahn, can you elaborate on the connection between view and samadhi? I notice when I meditate that my view has more inclination towards peace and understanding. Yes, exactly. And this is kind of the point, is that the deeper your samadhi is, the more your view, again, will align with the Dhamma. Because you start to understand where real happiness is. Samadhi, getting some degree of samadhi, no matter how much it is, will already show you a lot about where real happiness is to be found in the world. The more the samadhi is, the more you have abandoned the world around you. And you think, lo and behold, I give up all of these things that I thought were happiness. And now I feel far more happiness as a consequence. Yeah, so you can see how your view has changed so dramatically in such a completely different direction because of that. So that's why one of the things about samadhi is actually very important to inform your view. And this is one of the reasons why we say that samadhi and wisdom are two sides of the same coin. You get samadhi, you get wise to reality, you start to understand the three characteristics, in particular where dukkha and sukha, suffering and happiness, are to be found. So there's a very close relationship. And as your view turns correct, as it aligns with reality, yeah, it also enables samadhi. So from samadhi we get view, but samadhi is also a very view is also a very powerful condition for samadhi. Yeah? Because the more correct your view is, the more easy it is for you to give up, to abandon all those false happinesses in the world, and you enter samadhi so much more easily as a consequence. So that is a little bit about the connection between the two. Huh? Okay, so that is all for tonight. Thanks all for coming. Very nice to see you all here. And just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha towards the end.